Thank you.
I have Bob Levy to thank for that. That was his tip. Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. You know, during my nearly 50 years in business, I've had the privilege to work with some exceptional leaders and people, and none more so than our speaker today, Andrew Liveris. I've known Andrew since he was a puppy over 30 years ago, all through the Dow Chemical Company. He was a young engineer out of Australia. And if you know anything about Dow, we take people and we hire them from Australia or Europe or Latin America or United States, and we train them and we move them around. And Andrew's a typical leader in Dow. He's been in many, many countries. He's lived and worked in many countries. He's worked through sales, marketing, engineering, general management, you have it. And what you get is exceptional leaders, and Andrew's one of the best. I've known him for his tireless work ethic. Doesn't sleep very much, this man. And as you hear him today, you'll see why, what the outcome of that. And I also know him as a leader in our company and in our country. And more importantly, I know him as a dear friend. You know, in any industry, it's extremely rare to find a person who excels at both as a practitioner of his art and his business and as an ambassador. And Andrew really marries those two very, very well. Yes, he oversees a dynamic company, a materials science company, an agroscience company, but he's also an evangelist for the transformational power of the manufacturing sector as a whole, and how it can really help control America's destiny and lead us to a leadership position once again and bring manufacturing back to America, which is so critical to our success. He has literally written a book on it, crafting a set of policies and strategies that outline not only Dow's vision of advanced manufacturing, but providing practical suggestions and policies for all manufacturing. Andrew is the co-chairman of President Obama's Advanced Manufacturing Partnership and a member of the President's Export Council. He's also vice chairman of the Business Roundtable, and next month he'll be the first non-American to be the chair of the U.S. Business Council. And I can go on and on and on about Andrew, just come straight to surface, but suffice to say he's been recognized for his leadership around the country. And now it's time to hear from the man himself, the President, Chairman, Chief Executive Officer of Dow Chemical Company, Andrew Liveris. Andrew?
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I've got to tell you that this is a capstone for my week. I don't know what it's going to be like for you. Hopefully my talk makes it a capstone for yours. But I've started my week with my investor forum in New York City, and did what CEOs have to do, which is address the short term as we address the long term, and then spent a couple of days in Washington trying to solve a small issue that it should affect not just me but all of you, called the fiscal cliff, working with the President and the Business Roundtable, as Bill already alluded to. And frankly, I had to deal with a small little issue around an energy report that got published, so some of you may have seen me on TV this morning, and then of course run the company in between, as Bill was saying. And being here with you is just an honor, and Bill, I can't speak enough about your coaching, your mentorship. What he didn't say to you, and this is not a conspiracy, he's of Greek descent, I'm of Greek descent. There's not a lot more Greeks at Dow, don't worry. And the baton change at Dow occurred coincident with the Athens Olympics. We were in the hills of Athens, and he passed me literally the Olympic torch in the hills of Athens. It just coincided. I don't know if we were that good to plan it. And I got the baton, the torch, at that same day, and it was an amazing day in my life and my history with this great company. But to receive it from someone of Bill's stature, character, integrity, values, as a child of immigrants, and I am a child of immigrants, was just an important day in my life, and your mentorship and your legacy lives on in more than just me, at the entire company. and he's definitely worthy of being number one on your waiting list or whatever else comes with that. Tom, the Forum Club, you've told me a little bit about, and all of you as members and what you do here, and give me an opportunity to address some of the things that are happening in Dow's world and the world in general. I do want to also go to December 7th and what an important day it is to remember, and the people in the room who served our great country and all the veterans in the room. It's just, as we all know, it lives in infamy, and nothing like what you've done can eclipse what we do. So thank you for all of us, from our children and their children, for creating this great country's future. The greatest generation really did focus us on the future. And nothing focuses the mind, you know, like a crisis. Nothing focuses our minds like a common goal and a common vision. And that is very true today. At the end of the day, at the end of my talk, I will probably leave you with optimism. I hope I do. I am an optimist. You have to be in this job. And the series of economic crises that all of us have faced and seen these many years, maybe they're not like the Pearl Harbor crisis, but they are a crisis nonetheless. And they are reshaping our world before our very eyes. And really, they have refocused America's attention on the greatest challenge, I believe, before us in terms of economy and economic issues, and that is literally the remaking of our economy. The remaking of our economy for the next generation, and I use the verb making intentionally. I mean, as recently as 5 years ago, I would say to you the idea, as staggering as it was to me in my job and our industry, the idea of making it in America seemed to many like an antiquated notion. The talk shows, the Lou Dobbs, saw the inevitability that America should offshore, that should labor arbitrage, all these wonderful words that were being used, outsource, that there was inevitability. And the manufacturing sector that I represent, and I'm a very proud representative of the 52,000 women and men of the Dow Chemical Company, and by the way, because some of them are in the room, the 110,000 retirees of that same company. I am a willing representative, ambassador, advocate for what they stand for. And I will not allow, as long as I'm in this job and have this privilege, but no matter about this job, for them to be put down to the denominator, for them to be written off by economists and politicians, opinion leaders, media, you name it. I will not allow that to happen. It is my responsibility, our responsibility, to stand up and stand tall and speak to the value of their sector. This decline is not a fact of life. And of course, I'd love to tell you that we've dismissed it. We haven't. The work continues. But at least it no longer represents a consensus. It's quite the contrary. I think the momentum is beginning to shift. What the products and technologies that the making world, the manufacturing world does, the prosperity it creates, the value it creates, the benefits, is now more widespread as a conversation than it has been for the many decades before. And the inevitability of the decline seems to be arrested. It's not just business leaders like me, though, who are talking about this importance. It's starting to go to other sectors. Finally, economists are talking about it. And yes, even leaders in Washington, on both sides of the aisle, by the way, on both sides of the aisle, have a common view. And they are talking about it and are agreeing on its vitality, agreeing that manufacturing is and must remain a central part of this economy. And I think this shift is a very meaningful thing, but at the end of the day, as I've already alluded to, it's just a start. Agreement, actually, economists, politicians love to talk. It means nothing without action, without something happening. And now is the time to get back to the business of taking care of business. Now is the time to rebuild and remake America's manufacturing base and therefore the broader economy that goes with it. And I want to talk about that today. That's basically what I want to talk about, and I want to give you a sense of where the state of all of this is, where the state of American manufacturing is, and where it needs to be and how we as a country can actually take it there. So let me step back a little bit and give you a little bit of a sense of the state of American manufacturing. Because really, in our view, American manufacturing is still almost Dickensian-like, paraphrase Dickens, a tale of two sectors. On the one hand, there is a renaissance occurring. It's underway actually in many countries around the world, and I believe America is one of those. U.S. manufacturing has actually created nearly 500,000 jobs since January 2010. It's begun a rebound. More and more production that was once outsourced is starting to come back to the shores of this country. That is due in large part, no matter what anyone in Washington thinks, or for that matter, Lou Dobbs and his cohorts out there, the talking heads, it's due to one thing, energy and the shale gale. And anyone who thinks different to that, please see me or talk to me in the Q&A. The discovery of this unbelievable national treasure that our oil and gas industry has brought to us as a resource is unparalleled. It's tectonic, it's a game changer, and it's an opportunity. And it creates a set of competitive advantages for America, which of course the most important of them all, affordable energy for us all, so that our people don't have to go fight overseas for it. So that we celebrate our current veterans, but keep our children at home safely. This is why this year, U.S. manufacturers, in particular companies like Dow, have announced more than 100 new investments in this country, in the United States of America, totaling $90 billion in value add to this newfound resource. And these investments don't, unlike maybe an occasional editorial in occasional newspapers suggest, represent the profit of one company or one sector. It's a value add for the entire country. And by the way, it's not just blind optimism. It does reflect the great tectonic shift, the trade wind shift that's occurred for Advantage USA. But as I said, that's just half the story. Reality, as I well know and you all well know, is way more complex than just that part. Over the past several months, believe it or not, we seem to be doing a very, very good job of talking our way out of a recovery, of talking our way out of this great American advantage, of taking Advantage USA, and if you're a tennis player, taking that last serve to win the US Open and deciding to give it up and double fault all the time. We've seen a number of key sector indices drop, some to their lowest levels in years, real time, right now. Why? Why is this happening? One word, the current new normal of American business and global business, uncertainty. But uncertainty comes in many kinds. There are many uncertainties. Many of you have run businesses and are running businesses where you were used to uncertainty. But we are getting a complete new definition of uncertainty. From debt burden Europe to a slowing Chinese economy, to the uncertainty in the town I was in these last couple of days called Washington, and whether we can avoid going off this fiscal cliff. Uncertainty in the business community today, which is holding off trillions of dollars that are on the balance sheets that can go to job creation, that is frightening business leaders on whether to invest even with Advantage USA. A recent study by the Business Roundtable that Bill referenced found that CEOs were more pessimistic about our economic recovery today, the third quarter of 2012, than at any other time since January of 2009. And we well remember January of 2009. This has reached an inflection point again. We are right at it, right this very moment. We can take the renaissance I talk about, the first part of this, and make it a new reality. And we can create a new era of prosperity. Or we can let all sectors and the manufacturing renaissance in particular fall prey to this uncertainty, to this inattention in Washington, and to those in business and government who still believe that the United States can live without a strong manufacturing sector, let's just stand back and let it decline. Well, I've already indicated where I stand. Amongst my many things in the resume that weren't mentioned, I played rugby and I was in the scrum. And if you were in the scrum, survival was a pretty clear event. And I will never accept not coming back off that floor, off that stadium, off that turf, with maybe the tooth missing, and going back right there and getting back into that scrum. Not only am I passionate about manufacturing, I am confident in this country's ability and power to renew. I am confident in this country's ability to accelerate and transform. I am confident in what makes America great is still with us. Indeed, we need to stop thinking about manufacturing as a sector in need of rescuing and flip it and say it's the sector that can do the rescuing, as a sector that can create lasting prosperity on a scale that no other can. The data makes the case. According to a recent study from Boston Consulting, manufacturing has the potential, wait for it, to create 5 million new jobs by 2020. 5 million new jobs. It blows that celebrated jobs report out of the water that we got today. Here we are celebrating 140,000 jobs. Have we lost the plot completely? We need to get back to the type of manufacturing that creates those jobs, that realizes the ratio that every factory job, one job inside, creates 3 to 5 jobs around it, completes the supply chain, creates the community, creates the restaurants, the barbershops, and all the things that communities like this benefit from. That is a powerful multiplier effect, and one that is not actually limited to job growth alone. In order to extend every metric of this country's competitiveness, manufacturing does it all. It boosts productivity, it lowers prices, it accelerates innovation, increases consumer demand, and turns trade laggard sectors into trade leaders. Per unit of output, manufacturing businesses are nearly 10 times stronger exporters than services are. That is, in fact, in other words, the powerful force for economic renewal. Just back those stats. It's proven. And let me add, when I talk manufacturing, the brand manufacturing, this is not traditional assembly line jobs. This is not yesterday's jobs. This is actually the jobs of the future. These are jobs that create advanced technologies. These are high-paying jobs for highly skilled workers. These jobs create groundbreaking products like the ones we talked about at our table just now in state-of-the-art industries and innovate solutions to some of the world's biggest challenges, and that's precisely the work we're doing at Dow with our 7,000 PhDs. We have transformed our company over these past several years from a producer of basic products to high technology products to a solutions provider that's working at the intersections of all the sciences, that's working at the intersections of biology, chemistry, of physics and maths. And yes, the point at the table, political science is not a science. If you have to call it a science, it's not a science. So the intersections of science married with engineering and married with technology and growing companies based on innovations such as the smartphones in your pockets, advanced electronics. Two of the three colors are brought to you by Dow, blue and green and soon red. To equipment that makes offshore drilling safer so you never have to see a spill come back this way onto your shores. Technologies that Dow scientists are innovating every single day. And frankly, a great thing not just for our company but for our consumers, but for our country. And when we build high-value-add products like these in America, we also build capacity for future innovation. Innovation that leads to the next generation of products, like in marine engineering and your ambition. I can tell you that as a head of a global company that manufactures products and technologies and invents new ones, the idea that we can design it here and build it there has never worked. It's a myth. The two are together. The two are linked. And that is why 70% of all the R&D that's done in this country's private sector is in the manufacturing sector. 70% of all R&D. Now, countries like China get this, and they want it. They are working with speed to get that innovation to their economy. And not just them. You've heard of Samsung and Korea. You've heard of what Japan did. Okay, as they rebuilt their economy, they invested in manufacturing so they could get innovation. They built R&D centers alongside. They built universities to supply those R&D centers. And before you know it, the virtuous cycle that gets you to high-tech products, whether they be advanced batteries, advanced solar, advanced anything, is over there. Why do you think when we go there, we get red carpet, whereas when we go to Washington, we get red tape? Why? I mean, it's staggering. Who is not talking about this? Why are people not understanding that other countries want what we have, and they are working as we speak to get it? In a few short years, they will get it, and you'll see advanced manufacturing technologies and industries over there. And as you see them over there, they will have much more control over our economy than just owning our debt. They will actually own next generation jobs, the jobs that we need for our kids here. And not to dismiss the service sector, of course we need a service sector, but I've got news for you. China's building a service sector too. Okay. So when you think about all these things, and I can go on with other examples, you can't just do this by default. You can't just do like the Powerball thing last week and buy a lottery ticket and hope luck gets you there. About as much chance as a meteor hitting us right now, but okay. It takes thoughtful policy making. And as I said at the beginning of my remarks, it takes action. And around the world, the countries that are succeeding, and we're in 159 of them, are taking thoughtful action. They know what industries they want, and they know what industries are essential, and they're working with all stakeholders across their economy to win that business. More importantly, they're developing strategies for comprehensive manufacturing, policies around competitiveness to bring us here to there. The U.S. tumbled down to number 5 on the competitive index for the World Economic Forum just recently after being number 1 for decades. Don't ask me who the top 4 are. You will throw up. Sorry. They are setting the right kinds of priorities. They are making the right kinds of decisions. They're doing purposeful policy. Now, at Dow, not just writing this book, we developed a comprehensive advanced manufacturing plan for the president and the administration and for Congress, reviewed at our board, delivered to Washington, and it's sitting on the desks. The president, noticing this as a political opportunity, appointed an advanced manufacturing partnership that's come up with the American version of Dow's plan. Almost identical, but okay, we'll leave that be. As I've traveled around the country, talking to thought leaders, to governments, to investors, people around the country, it's very, very clear that when I talk about the specifics of the plan, which I'm going to go into in a few more minutes, there's great consensus. It's low-hanging fruit. It's waiting to be done. And by the way, doesn't need subsidy or your tax dollar. It just needs efficient government. Maybe an oxymoron. However, I said I'm an optimist. And in this new presidential term, we've re-begun. We've got the reset button. The silly season's over. Let's go. Let's go put this all in place. The insights we've gained in the meantime, the China story, the beginning of the issues over there. What I want to do with my remainder of my time is give you a sense of what's in this plan, and it isn't rocket science. I've already actually touched one of them, but I'm going to go down one more time into this because this is mind-blowing to me how we're squandering the energy opportunity. But there are 3 policy recommendations: that of energy, that of human capital, and that of the business climate. And these are simple headline recommendations. There's a detailed report. Happy to send it to you. Let me start with energy. Having no energy policy isn't a policy. and we don't have an energy policy. We're sitting in this country. There's no country on earth quite like this one. It has everything. It has a consumer market. It has a freedom model. It has intelligent institutions. It has an amazing ability to make the right decisions on everything. Like Winston Churchill said, America does finally make the right decision when it runs out of all other options. We may be there on energy. We finally have run out of all other options. It's very critical that we have this energy resource, that we put the right policies in place so we don't overregulate supply and kill it, and we don't regulate demand and subsidize the right wrong behaviors, like corn-based ethanol, for example. What happens in the absence of smart regulation is either bad regulation or, the worst, no regulation. In the absence of sensible policies, manufacturers, which, by the way, consume one-third of this nation's energy today, become significantly disadvantaged. Clear policies, in fact, do the opposite of uncertainty. They create a sense of certainty. It helps companies anticipate and make decisions and mitigate risk. And when it comes to anticipating whether they have access to energy resources, manufacturers are given almost zero guidance. When it comes to anticipating price, they're even given less. And we need to change that with a smart, comprehensive energy plan that reduces uncertainty and allows us to develop fuels and feedstocks responsibly. The elements of that plan and policy are fairly straightforward. We need to promote energy efficiency and conservation nationally. The average American home built over the last 10 years has a 4-foot hole in it due to lack of national standards. Shoddy building, shoddy construction, quick development, we all remember it. It was called the housing bubble. Every year, America wastes more than half the energy it produces. More than half. And buildings are responsible for 40% of that number. If we're looking for accessible, affordable energy, that's a no-brainer. Specifics available in a very thick report. The easiest BTU saved is the one not used, to state the obvious. Secondly, and more importantly, we need to optimize our hydrocarbon resources, particularly our natural gas. We have now got this discovery, this bountiful discovery of shale gas. It will create a massive advantage, and we need to seize it. Unfortunately, it is not a given. As you may be reading in the last 24 hours, some believe the best thing you can do with this is to burn it. Whoa, that's high tech. And burn it in transportation and in power stations. Well, when you do that, guess what? You don't have to be technical to know this. You use it once. And it's gone. It's one-time value add. Others would want you to export it. Now, I'm all for free markets and exports, but here's a big news item for you, flashing, breaking news. World energy markets are not free. 70% of the world's oil is controlled by governments and nation states, and they don't want to give it to you as the consumer unless they get the price and the jobs. Oh, what an aha moment that is. So why don't we take a minute? We've just discovered this stuff, 5 years ago to be precise. 5 years ago, we were talking about importing LNG. Why don't we just take a minute and figure out what we should do for it for our country? And instead of willy-nilly allowing licenses of export terminals and letting them all go overseas to give advantage somewhere else, like China, like Japan, like other countries, why don't we look at, instead of exporting liquids, exporting value-add solids? And that value-add is 20 times. Every dollar of gas can give you $20 inside the economy. When you talk about that in the context of revenues for the country and even tax revenues for the people who want to tax us more, you get an amazing boost. And in fact, this sector, $121 billion in additional economic input and output from affected industries, not just chemicals, all the affected industries, will create 200,000 new manufacturing jobs and another 1 million jobs right across the economy in these next 5 years. So I don't think you can allow this to just calibrate itself. We need a sound, proactive approach to the pricing structures of natural gas, one that balances exports with imports and supply with demand, one that takes freeze prices from the control of short-term forces like Wall Street, like hedge funds, like commodity investors, who send artificial signals every day on short-term paper. That is not a strategy. Indeed, one-third of manufacturing jobs lost over this last decade were lost due to the volatile price of natural gas. But natural gas alone will not revitalize manufacturing. We need to accelerate innovation in practical, affordable alternatives. And we at Dow have an opinion of that. We believe that should be in wind and solar, but it should be the result of the long game. Don't subsidize the short game. Really work hard on research and development and get to the long game. Those of you who remember Argonne National Labs and Bell Labs and the original labs that were built by this country to support the war effort know that we invented things because we had the long game in mind. In that case, to keep our country secure. In that case, to keep our country fed. In this case, to keep our country as an energy-rich country and stop sending people overseas to fight for it. We need to do that, the long game. And that includes developing alternatives. Taking invention to innovation is a risky business. There will be failures. But trust companies like Dow. We've been doing it for 115 years. We're still around. We're one of 9 companies still on the New York Stock Exchange from its founding. We know the long game. Bill Stavropoulos and his predecessors know the long game. Many companies like in America know the long game. We'll work with government to get the right long game. And the more that America competes for these alternatives, the more we will have a sustainable American energy future that's not just fossil fuel oriented. Climate change policies is not output driven, it's input driven. And the input that matters is brains. And that gets me to the second policy area, human capital. Global companies set up shop where talent is found. And right now, that place is not always the United States. In just 3 years, our workforce will need an additional 500,000 graduates in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Make no mistake, this talent shortage is here today. It's hard, and hopefully I can change your career trajectories by talking to these young kids. I do a little test about right now. Those of you in the audience with grown-up children, grandchildren, who are studying or have studied or have graduated in STEM, put up your hand. Science, technology, engineering, and math. Keep your hand up. If I said lawyers and doctors and all that, I think I'd get a different answer. Nothing wrong with those professions. Just need a rebalancing. To create supply, you need demand, to make the obvious statement. It's very critical that we don't just restrict it to the university system. We have to work with vocational training. We at Dow have partnerships at community colleges across the country to invest in apprenticeships and vocational training, to give young people the glory of a trade. And whatever that trade may be, high technology trades, to celebrate it with high paying jobs in high tech areas such as automation and robotics and high tech equipment manufacturing, like medical equipment. We've got to do what Germany has done so well, and really rebuild our skilled workforce across the supply chain, across the talent pipeline. And by the way, a quick bow to immigration. This accent wouldn't be here if you didn't have the right immigration policies. Why are we fooling around with that? People want to come to America. Why are we making it harder for them? The third area is, in fact, making things harder. It's called the business climate. We need policies to change the game on business environment. We need them now. And when your metric for success is not falling over a fiscal cliff, we have reached a sad state of affairs when that's a metric for success. Around the country and around the world, business leaders are skeptical. I've been to 38 countries this year, not counting the United States. Governments around the world just don't understand what's happening with Washington. And it's not just this week and last week and this month and the last many months. It's almost been a decade of dysfunctionality. For my part, and I'm very fresh on this, and maybe you can ask me questions, I believe they will resolve the crisis, the immediate one. They will get to an answer. The alternative is too awful to contemplate. There is a crisis, and if we don't do the right thing here, we will send ourselves into an economic recession. We at Dow probably wouldn't run away from our investments on the U.S. Gulf Coast, $4 billion, because at least we have the energy advantage for now. But many companies are stopping hiring and will begin firing. And we're going to go back to the 08-09 period. 40% of all U.S. companies are now holding off on their investments. We understand free market systems. We understand political uncertainty. But we certainly don't understand self-inflicted uncertainty. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Why is Washington failing to reach compromise? Why are we not getting the right answers? I'm sure you have your own opinions, but the dysfunctionality is on both sides. This is all about the next election cycle, and we already are thinking about a year and a half from now. Okay, this is just not the way to reach consensus. And passing a smart deficit reduction plan is not that complicated on the arithmetic if you have everything on the table and go to the back room and Lyndon Johnson-like, or evoke your favorite president who reached compromise in the back room, Ronald Reagan, with the speaker at the time. It's possible to get done. In our view, it's also possible to get it done and create some business certainty and even some business advantage, like a better corporate tax rate, maybe even a territorial system, a pure one. After all, we're now the only country in the world outside of one country in the Nordic that has doesn't have a territorial system. But the business climate, unfortunately, can't be done anymore in isolation without talking to Washington. We have been there, and we are engaged, and I'd love to take your questions on this topic if you wish. I want to start concluding by my recognition of how difficult what I've just talked about is. These are not easy things to do, the energy policy, how we look at the talent pipeline for the long game, how we look at improving the business climate. It requires enormous effort. But here's another truism. The golden triangle of our world has truly arrived, and it's not off the Florida shores. The golden triangle for these young people's world is the three parts of the triangle are now linked. Business, government, and society are linked. Every policy framework, every technology I launch at Dow, every decision one takes has that linkage in mind. Sustainability is no longer a noun, it's an adjective. Sustainable business, sustainable profits, sustainable planet, sustainable generations. That many years ago, when the smoke cleared at Pearl Harbor, Americans realized they had the long game. They had to do what had to be done. And there was a remarkable industrialist by the name of Henry Kaiser who answered the call for action. Working together with military and other leaders in the business world, he cleared the hulls of the sunken ships in Pearl Harbor. He rebuilt the docks and the airstrips. And he actually readied Pearl Harbor to serve as a major center for what became the Pacific operations in the Second World War. Then he went and did it again in Guam. He did it again in Samoa and Wake Island. It was later said of Henry Kaiser, as it was of thousands of business leaders at the time that contributed to the war effort, that few gave America so big a push towards victory and none with a sunnier, more optimistic face. Well, the challenges we face today are not as daunting as those, but the attitude required is not all that different. We need the same resolve to do the hard things right, the same spirit of partnership between government, business, and society. And yes, the thing I'm most proud of in being a part of your great country, that unique brand of American optimism that is unique to this great country. I won't stand for anything less, and I hope in your questions you test me on that as I get back into my rugby scrum environment this week. Thank you very much.
Andrew, thank you. Thank you very much. And you did end up on a very optimistic note. I'm going to ask you who have traveled to 38 different countries, to at least take a couple of books with you that will remind you of the small area in Southwest Florida where you were today, a book about Marco Island and about Naples, Florida, as a little thank you for being here today. So,
thank you very much, Tom. Thank you.
And Bill? And Bill will come up and ask some questions.
That was a hell of a speech, and I got a fistful of questions here. And Andrew, a lot of topics you covered, but I think people want some application. Let's start off from the top, okay?
Please.
Is Obama anti-business?
No. I mean, but you've got to understand that the attribute of the leader in place is in the resume, and the resume is a community organizer, and a person who's grown up in a different environmental backdrop. And a person who doesn't have the business skills that you are asking about in that question is apparent to us all. I'm not proud of this next statement, and Jim Ringler, you may test me at the next board meeting. Jim's a board member of Dow, and Bill, please don't kill me for it. During the first term, I was asked to the White House 24 times. This man is trying. He's trying to understand business. He's got some flaws around his attempts, and one of them is what you and I do is surround ourselves with people who know more than we do, like those scientists.
Right.
And that's the big failure, unlike the Lincoln example, President Lincoln. So what he doesn't know is hurting him badly in the dialogue. It's literally like you speaking Greek to one of these guys, speaking English back to you. Different language.
It's all Greek to you. That's good. Let's talk a little bit about Dow.
Yes.
Comment on the complications for a capital-intensive company like Dow, for a matter of fact, any manufacturing company, to operate in an environment without the national policy. Would you just kind of help
about it? So the sector that we represent is a value-add sector. There isn't anything on your table or on this floor in this room that we don't touch in our value chain, but we're invisible to you, with the exception of a few products. Unfortunately, as a consequence of that, the energy input required for the sector, I've talked a lot about in the speech, and the prices of the output, which, let's call it, on one side of me I have Exxon, on the other side of me I have Walmart. These aren't small companies. They have major price power on either side. One's the price of the consumer, the other is the price of the energy companies, which, if you haven't gathered, are fairly small numbers. I already mentioned the nation-state ones. So what I have to do in Dow as a company, what we have to do, is innovate away from that dependency. The capital intensity to do that is the footprint relies on the energy inputs, but the human capital is the scientists I talked about. To innovate your way to high-tech products, companies don't do that easily. IBM did, 3M did, GE did, Honeywell did, UTC did. We're doing it. We're not yesterday's Dow, but we're not tomorrow's Dow yet either. So we have a dependency on these energy inputs, and that you've heard me talk about it, that is unique. I'm not an energy company. I am not going to benefit from exporting LNG. I know who will. There's six companies who will. Is that the right thing for the economy? So I will talk about that in terms of the current footprint, but obviously we're trying to innovate away from it.
Do you think that the politicians and environmentalists will stop and seriously limit natural gas fracking?
I think the fracking conversation is starting to solve itself, with the exception of one state in the Northeast that will never get it. guess which one that is.
Right.
The others need the jobs. Pennsylvania, Ohio, you know, West Virginia, the states that are more, you know, I'm going to use the word desperate for alternative jobs. They're seeing what's happening in the Dakotas and other states that do get it. And the consequence of that is, I think, sensible regulation, which is, by the way, the only answer to regulation, which is consultative with industry. The technology is manageable.
Right.
It's very doable. There's only a few parts of the country in all these places where the aquifers are so close to the actual shale formations. They're miles distant. Everyone will tell you this is proven technology, so you can regulate smartly to have both.
Good. That's Michigan, as you know, passed the right to work law, and that was, I think, a dramatic event for Michigan. And what impact do you think they'll have on Dow?
Well, look, as you know, I said the golden triangle of business, government, society, and obviously whenever you get a group representing a part of society, give me a big part of the apple and, you know, I'll leave the core for you, you'll get General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so this distribution of wealth, by the way, I don't want to make you pessimist again, but one term I didn't use in the talk that I feel is a switch going on at the national level. This country was built on shared prosperity. Our leader, the president, uses shared sacrifice all the time. And shared sacrifice is a different lens for economic wealth creation in this country that I think speaks to the way it's being approached. The good news is in Michigan and a few other states I can mention, we've gotten smart, pragmatic governors that are working with smart legislatures that are starting to redefine the share of the profit pie. And of course, workers should have a very big share of it, but not the deterministic share. After all, if you don't have profit, you're not going to have jobs. So to state the obvious case, it'll have a profound effect, Bill.
Good. I got signals. One more question, and the big question I left the last is, what is your view of the fiscal cliff, and how is this thing going to finally come? And give us stories of what's happening in the back room there.
Yeah, so the good news is that businesses are being consulted, and we were brought into the White House pretty much the week after the election, which was new behavior, and we weren't lectured to, which is also new behavior. We were asked to give our inputs, and we were coordinated. As I said, there's nothing quite like a crisis to bring everyone together, so all the different sectors are of like mind here. Don't let us go off the cliff, and don't put this self-inflicted economic reversal in place to this great recovery. And I would tell you that the inputs that the president is asking of would scare you all. This is common sense 101. I'm pretty sure if I go to every table here and we sat for 5 minutes, you'd come up with the elements that make sense. The problem is obvious. The solutions are obvious. The components of the solution need to be detailed. Staggeringly, both sides have put out enough detail to find consensus. But the big topic is nothing to do with the data and the logic, and the back rooms up until this week were not working. And if I'm going to leave you with a positive story, as of the last 48 hours, they're now working. I mean, for goodness sakes, the president is calling the speaker. What a revelation that would be, don't you think? That would be like a good first starting point. And he's now doing it regularly. The speaker, in turn, is starting to signal the things that he can do and he can't do. He's got a very fragmented Republican base. I know where this community is, but I will tell you, you're not representative, believe it or not, of where the country might be. And when I say the country, not all the country either. So all these different parts of the Republican Party need to come to terms with something which is out there, rate increases for the wealthy, and so define what that means. If you want my view, clearly there will be rate increases for the wealthy. There is no way out of that, and the Republicans will give up on that. But they don't want to give it up and not get the other stuff. And so the other stuff then becomes important. That detail is being worked on right now. I just got off a conference call this morning. The business community is playing an amazing role, which I'm very staggered that we're even being asked, which is to keep them together in negotiation. So keeping both sides, the entitlement side, specifics, and obviously on the revenue side, do what needs to be done, but don't kill business, the job creators. So how to keep that optionality. Chances it'll have a solution of the mini kind to signal to markets are better than 50%, but not 90%. Chances that we will come off the cliff, therefore the reverse of those numbers.
Right.
And the consequence of that is a dysfunctionality that I don't think we've yet witnessed. The current dysfunctionality is bad enough, but the next lot of dysfunctionality will be catastrophic because, of course, you've got the levers of the debt ceiling conversation, which are congressional, that will be used once this doesn't get done. So there, you know, we in the business community just decided we're going to put out a massive campaign. The Business Roundtable has half the nation's GDP. We're going to get to every single employee to put out a massive call to action in these next 7 days to get these folk in the room to get the right compromise. If you have any influence on that, please do the same. I'd say, Bill, I worry that we will come off the cliff, and I'm suited at Dow, you know this.
Right.
I'm suited at Dow as if 2012 and 2013 are going to be the same and that the options to come off the cliff are real.
Okay. That's a call of action.
That wasn't optimistic, though.
That
wasn't optimistic.
No, that's a call of action.
Thank you very, very much.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Andrew Liveris, and we'll see you all on January the 11th.